Welcome to the Sleep Junkies podcast. My name's Jeff Mann. I'm the founder and editor of sleepjunkies.com, and we cover the whole conversation on sleep. So today we're going to do another roundup of some of the latest sleep research and science that's been popping up in the news in recent weeks. And there are literally new studies and new reports coming out in the field of sleep medicine, sleep science every day. And there's obviously not enough time to cover all of this, so we've just picked four that we find interesting. And we've invited back one of our regular guests, Dr. Neil Stanley, who's been involved in sleep science and sleep research for over 30 years. And we're going to try and dive behind the headlines a little bit, try to delve a little bit into why and how the implications of these new findings are significant. And in general, just take a look at the way sleep science is reported in our news feeds and how it's made accessible to the general public. So that's it for the introduction. If you're liking the podcast, don't forget to subscribe. We're on iTunes and Spotify and Google Podcasts, all those places. You can check us out on social, on Instagram. We've got a Facebook group, Sleep Junkies Worldwide. We're all over Twitter. And of course, you can find us on the website, sleepjunkies.com. So hope you enjoy this episode. On with the show. Good morning. Well, I'm joined today with one of our regular guests, Dr. Neil Stanley. Good morning, Neil.
Good morning.
We're going to do one of our roundups of recent research and sleep science that's been in the news. And we did one of these at the end of last year, and Neil contributed to that. And we kind of explained at the time that there's so much stuff out there, isn't there, Neil?
Yeah, you know, what's becoming ever more clear is that there's more and more information. Every week now, there is a story that makes you think, whereas in the past, perhaps thought that we had the right answer. If we knew what we were talking about. But now every day or every week, there seems to be a paper that comes out that changes fundamentally the way we think about sleep. So it's not a done deal in any way. And that's perhaps the exciting bit about it.
It is exciting. And I would say every day. I mean, I'm on Facebook. I'm seeing literally every day there's people posting new papers. We're going to pick four stories. And these are ones that have maybe had a bit more coverage in the media, in the mainstream media, as well as the scientific press. And these are ones that sort of piqued my interest. And I'm hoping, Neil, just for anyone who's not aware, I hope you don't mind me saying, it's fair to say you've been around the block in the field of sleep research and science.
37 years experience. So, that's what is perhaps really great about it, that still after 37 years, I can be surprised by things rather than thinking I know it all.
Anyway, let's dive in. So we've got four stories. And first one, it's maybe a little bit of a fun one here. And this is a study that came out very recently in the journal Current Biology. Some of our audience may have seen this, and it's a study, well, it's actually a couple of studies to do with the fact that being rocked while you're asleep has lots and lots of benefits to sleep quality. And we're all aware that babies get rocked to sleep, and that's a kind of a thing that any new parent does. They rock their baby to sleep. But as it turns out, there are lots of benefits for adults as well. I'll just read out some of these. So this is a study that was a follow-up to a study a few years ago where a scientist, a sleep researcher, studied people napping and set up a rig where the participants were rocked to sleep while they were napping. And then recently they've done a whole night experiment along the same lines, and they found that the participants fell asleep quicker, they slept more soundly, they had fewer arousals during the night, an increase in sleep spindle activity, they had longer periods of deep sleep, and also they did some memory and learning tests which were improved by rocking. So what do you think about this, Neil?
Well, this is one of these very puzzling pieces of research. I mean, not in any way questioning the quality of the research, because it's from a very, very respected group. But as a scientist, whenever you read something, you always have to ask the question, why? What's the benefit of this? And as you said in your introduction, babies get rocked to sleep. However, there's not a sort of an evolutionary belief that, you know, humans have ever done anything other than sleep on the floor or on a bed, that we've never, as adults, been rocked. So why would there be something beneficial by being rocked? You know, something would have evolved only if it is beneficial to us. So if we've always slept on the ground, we've never rocked, therefore why? Now, the things that you mentioned about, you know, falling asleep more quickly, better memory, are of course important things for children. And as you mentioned, babies are rocked. But as adults, why would rocking be beneficial? And I know they've described the sort of the mechanism of synchronizing brain waves, but why? And more importantly, I think for the listeners, is how? How is this going to be translatable? Are we in 5 years' time going to be buying beds with four electric motors at each corner that are going to gently rock us to sleep? I mean, is it something that is translatable into something that will be beneficial? Is this the start of, you know, the bed that will, you know, definitively help you sleep? I genuinely don't know, because I say it's just a puzzle. Evolution doesn't do things that aren't necessary because they would have died out. So what is the point of rocking for humans? So it's certainly fascinating science, but I say I just don't know why. I don't know what it means.
Well, it's funny because I sort of had exactly the same thoughts about evolutionary biology. Yeah, humans sleep on the floor, and maybe our ancestors, the apes, were sleeping in the trees. So I'm thinking, well, maybe if we came from the trees and the branches were swaying slightly, there's some kind of benefit to being gently rocked in the branches. But regards to human biology, there's nothing, as you say, there's no precedence for saying that it would be an advantageous thing.
I mean, of all the apes, the only ape that actually sleeps on the floor is the gorilla. Everyone else does sleep in the trees. Now, the perception is, from an evolutionary point of view, we're closer to gorillas than we are to chimpanzees. Also, I fully accept your reasoning, but then you could overlay on top of that if you're in a tree and it's swaying, you actually perhaps would want to be more alert rather than less alert. I would rather my world was not moving. But maybe, as I say, maybe it is an evolutionary hangover, literally an evolutionary hangover from, you know, the days that our ancestors did spend the time in the trees. And maybe it is comforting. Maybe it's a protective mechanism that you don't worry. Because, as you said, they did rocking. It wasn't like shaking. And maybe there is a dose response curve to this. Maybe, you know, we need to get that Swiss bed and turn the volume up a bit and see, you know, if it is protective, so you do sleep, you know, what could potentially be a mild stress condition, that sleep's important and then this is protective. However, in a force 10 gale, if I was the if I had that bed, that would be the study I'd be doing. Is there a level of rocking that the benefits are then negated by the vigilance of perceived risk? I shall write to the Swiss and suggest that as their next topic.
Yeah. I have actually seen one. Something came up in Twitter or somewhere. Someone's actually invented a rocking bed quite recently. But I think, put it this way, I don't think the bedding industry is going to change. And I don't think, you know, all these billion-dollar bed companies are now going to start inventing rocking beds. I mean, there is one. I don't know if you've seen it. It's this $1,000 crib.
The bassinet that rocks for
babies. And that there's loads and loads of people who testify that it really does work with babies. But it's really, really curious with adults. So what they think is happening is that we've got these organs in our ears in humans, this vestibular system, which is their balance organs. And what they think is happening is that there's this synchronization going on between the way we sense motion and spatial awareness. And that is having a synchronizing effect on the frequencies that are conducive to sleep. And also sleep spindles. Can you just explain that for people who may not be aware?
Well, sleep spindles are a specific characteristic of the EEG, the electroencephalograph. And essentially what they are short bursts of activity. And the very, very characteristic of stage N2 sleep, but we're not absolutely clear what they do. There is a belief that they're involved in being protective of sleep. So the more spindles you have, the more you're well slept, although you're not in the deepest stage of sleep, the more or the less likely your sleep is disturbed. And this was work done with noise stimulus during the night. And so, again, if this rocking is engendering spindle activity, then there could be the perception that, again, they say that that is protective of sleep. Spindles are also involved in memory. They're not the main part of memory. Memory, again, happens in the N3 sleep. But spindles in N2, they do seem to have some involvement, which, again, would potentially explain why there is this overnight memory improvement. But, yeah, the vestibular system is essentially just three tubes full of liquid and hairs, and that's just, you know, so when you get dizzy and you stop and you still feel like you're spinning, that's just because the fluid in the vestibular system is still flowing before it settles down and you get over your dizziness. Again, any link between that and the generation of sleep, again, would just be an explanation of why rocking helps a baby. And, of course, some people claim to sleep really brilliantly on small boats being gently rocked by the tide, or, you know, people fall asleep on sleeper trains and that because of the gentle rhythmic motion. And I say perhaps in the past we ascribe that just to it being relaxing rather than actually there being any physiological reason for it. So it would seem that they've suggested the pathway. They've certainly had a measurable effect. It certainly makes sense in scientific terms. And, you know, it just comes down to whether this is a thing that we should be investigating. You know, if a rocking bed can stop people taking sleeping tablets, then I'm all for it. You know, non-pharmacological methods are always preferable to pharmacological methods if there is one. I certainly think this is worth some serious investigation in sort of bigger patient groups. I mean, whether this is going to be something that's protective in any sort of mildly stressful situation like pain or anxiety or depression or something like that, whether this mechanism can be adjudged, whether you have to move the whole bed, you know, the vestibular system's in the ear, whether, you know, just a pillow that gently rocks backwards and forwards. I mean, that could be possible. Mm. That could have a benefit. Yeah. I don't know. Again, I don't know why you'd want to shift the whole body necessarily. I mean, I know why you do that with a mouse because it's a bit difficult to do any otherwise. But with a human, it might just be you could invent a clever pillow.
Fascinating. But as you say, maybe opens up more questions than it answers.
Well, yeah, that's it. As a scientist, that's all you're trained to do is ask the question why until, yep, you know, reducto ad absurdum, until you get the answer.
We'll pause that one and hopefully, you know, in the coming months and years, we'll find out a bit more exactly why, you know, these results are showing, but certainly very interesting. So we'll watch this space on that one. Okay, moving on. Now, this new study that came out last month got a lot of press. And again, it's one of these ones that generates a lot of clickbait headlines. And the headlines were along the lines of new parents face up to 6 years of sleep deprivation. And this was in the journal Sleep. And it's an observational study. And it was done over 7 years. This was self-reported data. And it was only collected once a year. But it was about 2,500 women and about 2,000 men. And what they did is they were asked to give a subjective score on how their sleep was between 1 and 10 over this period of not being a parent and then becoming a new parent and then becoming parents of slightly older children. And it turned out that this big population, and these was a group of participants in Germany, it didn't improve, did it? Even after 6 years, these new parents were reporting that their sleep didn't improve. And the women lost, on average, 41 minutes of sleep in the first year. The men lost 14 minutes of sleep. But the message from this is that if you become a parent for the first time, your sleep isn't going to go back to pre-parent levels for up to 6 years.
Well, yeah, I mean, as you mentioned, there are sort of limitations. I mean, asking people once a year how they slept and how they remembered sleeping, it might just, they may view their pre-pregnancy sleep in some sort of halcyon utopian fashion. This was a wonderful time, and then pregnancy ruined it all, sort of thing. So there is that issue of your baseline. But it is of course true. I mean, we rather assume that children, and certainly in this day and age, there's this idea of competitive parenting where people are, you know, there's books out there saying, you know, get your baby sleeping through the night in 8 weeks and all that sort of nonsense. And so there is this perception that babies are going to disturb your sleep in the short term and not perhaps in the longer term. But if you look at the science, a child's sleeping pattern doesn't even start to resemble anything that we as an adult would consider normal until they're around 6 years old. And of course, it's the parent's job to look out for the child. I mean, you know, you are providing safety and protection for the child. That's your role, because human children are pretty useless until they're about 18 years old. They can't sort of fend for themselves. So parents have to be around. And we know from other work that women are hardwired to hear their baby much more than fathers. Again, if you look at primitive cultures, many, many cultures have the women sleeping hut where the women and children sleep, and then there's the male sleeping hut where the men sleep. But as I say, it's the duration. I think most people would happily expect a child to disturb them for a year or 18 months, but the fact that it is, from this research, 6 years may be the thing that comes as a surprise. What was puzzling was the way the British media reported this thing, because I didn't actually know whether it was going to be you had sleep deprivation for a period of 6 years or whether you lost 6 years of sleep. There were some missing words when this was reported that made it sound a lot worse than it actually was. I thought it was, you know, a really dramatic sleep loss, but saying that a child would disturb you, and if you think about it, 41 minutes of sleep whilst profound is not 4 hours, which, you know, is what you get from many reports from parents, is that they barely slept. So is 41 minutes in a woman really clinically significant? Probably not. Certainly 14 minutes sleep for a man in the first year, really, I would not consider clinically relevant. It may be statistically significant, but not really clinically relevant to the health and well-being of the father. So actually, if you look at the data in that respect, then parenthood doesn't actually seem to be that difficult.
Well, I mean, for men, 14 minutes lost, it doesn't really sound much of a big deal. Compared to the general upheaval of, you know, becoming a parent for the first time.
It sounds bad, but, you know, waking up at 15 minutes early is not going to have any effect on anybody functioning, mental or physical functioning, the next day.
And we talked about this on the last one. The media likes to talk up some of these headlines about sleep science and sleep research and try and scare people sometimes. But when you actually dig into this, you know, new parents face up to 6 years of sleep deprivation. On the outset, it sounds quite horrific. But really, when you look at the actual evidence, considering what a life change it is for people, couples to become parents for the first time, you're going to sort of have to expect some life changes when you become a parent. So to me, it doesn't really seem to be that much of a big deal, the numbers that are born out of this study. Maybe you'd think, yeah, after 6 years, things might have gone back to normal. But really, you know, there's going to be some consequences.
But this, of course, as you say, is a problem with the media, because what happens so often in this day and age is that the journalists do not read the scientific paper. Journals, scientific journals or the university will put up out a press release, which basically journalists will swallow whole, which usually has a quote from the lead author or the principal investigator that states something that's never actually mentioned in the paper. Because he's been told by the press officer to make it relevant, because when it becomes assessed in the research assessment exercises, you've got to show real-world evidence or real-world relevance for your paper. I've done this a number of times in the last year, that I've read a headline, I thought, that's fascinating, and read a quote from the lead author, and I've gone to the paper, and they don't actually mention any of the words that are in the press release. You know, the whole concept, whole telltale signs. If you see a story in the newspaper and says this will lead to new treatments – for insomnia or jet lag or anything like that, you know absolutely certainly that that has never been said in the paper. That is just coding to get the media to pick up on that story.
That's not the role of the scientist to say that, you know, they're yeah. just putting the evidence out there.
Absolutely, and this is the problem. So I say the media have these bugbears. They have this lovely way of picking the most catastrophic story rather than perhaps the most interesting stories. A story that makes the picture more complex is not going to be beneficial. A thing that says, oh, yes, you know, parents are not going to sleep for 6 years. Well, that's not actually what it said, but, you know.
Okay, so the third one, this is something I didn't really see that much coverage of, but I'd certainly not come across this line of research before. Interested to get your opinion on this, Neil. So this was a study that came out in the Journal of Physiology recently, and it's to do with our body clocks, things that shift the timing of our body clocks. Now, normally the big one that we always hear about is light, but this one, they found that exercise. It was quite an interesting methodology they use. So they took about 100 subjects. They made them exercise at different times of the day. And then I think they did urine tests to test for melatonin and other kind of stuff. And then they found some different results for the times that people exercised had an impact on when their clocks were shifted, this idea of phase shifting. And some of the press, it was saying that, well, maybe this is another avenue we can look at apart from light to deal with things like jet lag and shift work. And the key findings that were talked about in here, that in order to advance your body clock, they found two little timing windows. So you either exercise at 7 in the morning or between 1 and 4 in the afternoon, and that would shift your body clock earlier. Have you come across this type of research before, Neil?
No, I mean, this is interesting. What I mean, again, in your introduction, you covered the field really quite well. We you know, it's obvious that light and dark are the primary time giver, the primary Zeitgeber, and you know, jet lag was always thought of as you know, just desynchronization of the body clock from the light dark cycle. And then about 10 years or so ago, we realized that not only did we have the light dark cycle, but we also had a food related clock. And so not only was, when we talked about jet lag, did we say, well, you know, if it's light when you get there, stay awake. If it's dark when you get there, go to sleep. We also started adding the caveat also of eat at the culturally acceptable time. So if it's breakfast in America, then eat breakfast. Now, your body may really not want to be eating breakfast at that time of the morning, so you don't have, you know, hash browns and steak fries, but you maybe have a chocolate bar or something. But that's one way of inducing rhythm. And this is going to sound utterly ridiculous, but you only exercise during the day. And I can remember my professor Ian Hindmarch used to say, you know, the best way to get a good night's sleep is to be awake during the day. If you give your body something to do during the day, then you need to have sleep at night. And, you know, this shifting of the clock seems to be in the same manner as light and dark, or the use of light in jet lag. And that, you know, one presumes these people were exercising in light under constant conditions. So how you can separate the effects of it being light from the effects of doing physical exercise. But, you know, there has to be something about that, that 1 to 4 p.m. is when we have the post-lunch dip. That doesn't require food to happen. It's just an evolutionary hangover. So maybe powering through that by doing some exercise can reset the clock. And maybe 7 a.m. in the morning is a really, really good way of confirming to the body that it's time to get up and get going, and maybe that. So, yes, I do see some utility of this in potentially in jet lag and shift work, that, you know, shift workers are certainly that they don't eat healthy food. You know, if they're in a factory, they don't have canteens because canteens is closed during the night, and they just eat stuff out of vending machines or the local fast food outlet. And, you know, because they're working at odd hours, their motivation and energy levels are probably not that good to try and persuade them to do exercise. And so maybe that would be a potentially beneficial thing to look at, how that could be used. In terms of jet lag, well, yeah, you know, if you get somewhere and it's sunny, don't just sit in your hotel room staring out the window. Get outside, go into the park and do something beneficial. I mean, I know there's one multinational hotel chain. This is certainly something that I find horrific personally, but there is one major hotel chain in America. They have 14 hotels that actually have a gym in the bedroom. They have weights and cardio equipment in the bedroom. It's known as 5 feet from fit. So you can get out of your bed and you can go to the gym. So I think that's horrific. But somebody, evidently the Americans like it, because when I posted on LinkedIn, I got a whole lot of abuse being told that it was a good thing. But maybe we should, you know, if you're jet lagged, you feel a bit rubbish, you feel demotivated, you feel life is more difficult. Maybe we should sort of take the stairs rather than going up in the lift or all those sorts of things. Because as I say, it's just a good way of confirming to your body that it's daytime, it's time to be awake. And as I say, that's the best thing we can do. So exercising outside on a bright summer's day, yeah, your quid's in.
I find it interesting because we just did another podcast with this company Time Shifter, Dr. Stephen Lockley, who's done a load of work with astronauts and Formula One drivers, and he's actually been applying this, and he's worked a lot in this area of timed light exposure. And it seems we've kind of got the science down to when is a good time to be exposed to light with regards to shifting your clock to adjust to jet lag. And it seems like there's a reasonable body of evidence to say, you know, there's practical methods we can apply to that. But with regards to shift work, I think shift work is a big problem because we live in a 24/7 world now. People have to do shift work. There's no way around it. But you can't, if you're doing shift work, you can't suddenly say, okay, right, in order for my body clock to be and my health to be optimal, I need to have 2 hours of darkness. That doesn't work because you're at work. But I'm thinking maybe, you know, if there's a way exercise can help with this, you know, that could be potentially, if we can get more evidence, something that could be really useful to helping people cope with shifts.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, now with tunable white light, with LEDs, we can use light. Professor Chuck Seisler said, you know, light is a drug. You know, it can be powerful enough to shift, you know, circadian rhythms and affect our mood and our sleep, et cetera, et cetera. And again, as somebody who spent my scientific career looking at the effects of medication, there's three things you need to know about. If you have a drug, you need to know the dose, you need the timing, and you need the formulation. So, you know, we have people who are using, you know, yellowy light, 2,700 Kelvin, which is the light to help you go to sleep, or you use 6,500 Kelvin, which is that bright blue white light, which, you know, wakes you up and you know, makes you more productive. So the light bulb can do anything. And, you know, if you're working in a day in an open plan office, then maybe using tunable white light, you know, could be beneficial. But as you say, in shifts, that's not going to be easy, because if you used 6,500 Kelvin bright white light overnight, you would actually make the shift work worse. You may get them more productive, but the whole 24-hour period, you would be, you know, really, really imposing daylight on them. So timed exposure, as you mentioned, Steve Lockley's work, you know, I used to work with Steve and the University of Surrey many years ago. You know, it's good work. And yes, if you've got a Formula One team that stays in the best hotel and has private jets, it's probably beneficial. But unfortunately, most people's lives are messy. And certainly shift work is a messy, from a scientific point of view, a messy for place. So as you say, maybe an exercise routine in shift workers is one, much more acceptable, and two, probably less harmful overall to their circadian rhythms than potentially using light would be.
Yeah, really interesting one. Okay, last study. Now, again, this is something I found fascinating, because it's this is something that is one of these real fundamental questions. And it's, again, some of the headlines that came out were a little bit hyperbolic, but it's a study on fruit flies. Maybe you can explain why fruit flies are so big in sleep science. But the premise of this piece of research was that they use this new fancy machine learning technique to observe fruit flies. And basically, they found certain proportion of the population of these fruit flies were more or less what they described as sleepless. So they said the average was between 300 and 600 minutes a day. But some of these flies were only sleeping like 4 minutes a day. They didn't really have this need for sleep. And pretty much universally, we get taught this idea that sleep is so fundamental to our biology that if we skip sleep, we will die, basically. And these kind of things are based on some animal experiments that they've done. And they've done a few on, again, fruit flies and cockroaches. But the famous one is rats, isn't it? They deprive rats of sleep. And when they deprive these rats of sleep by dunking them in water every time they dropped off on this spinning disc, they found that the rats just died. They never really found the cause of why this happened. But this research is kind of saying, well, actually, there's some animals out here that they don't actually need sleep. And I'm like, hang on, that's a sort of a paradigm change from what we've been told. What do you think about this, Neil?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is interesting. I mean, this again throws up many, many questions. The reason why science uses fruit flies is because they're very, very simple, and you can breed them very, very easily, and nobody cares what you do to a fruit fly because they're not cuddly, and you can very easily muck about with their genetic makeup, so you can create, you know, different types and take genes out. And this research was done in wild type, so, you know, perfectly normal fruit flies. Now, again, we are told that sleep is a biological necessity. I mean, the longest we know any humans ever staying awake was Randy Gardner back in the 60s, who stayed awake for 11 and a half days, seemingly without any negative effects. Now, has anybody ever done a sleep deprivation study, if you'd want to call it that, on people who, you know, were fundamentally killed by being deprived of sleep? I am unaware of anything in the literature, even the most evil regimes of the 20th century.
Maybe some really dark sort of, you know, black ops military experiment they've done.
Well, yeah, again, I mean, you know, the US military are interested in keeping people awake, but their target was 7 days, which is possible. But I say, even the most horrendous things, I have never heard of anybody sleep depriving somebody to death, and so we really don't know what the human limit. It is thought, extrapolating from the rat work that you mentioned, that it was going to be something like 14 to 16 days is as long as the human could do without sleep.
Right.
But we are big and we are complex, whereas a fruit fly is not big and complex. We do know that in some of these shrews and voles who have to eat their entire body weight every day to survive, we do know that in those animals, if they are in a situation of starvation, they can override their need from sleep, because the need to eat is vastly more important than the need to sleep. In that very, very temporary, you know, 1 or 2 days, they have to eat. They don't potentially have to sleep for that period of time. So that, you know, mice or shrews and voles are slightly complex. Fruit flies aren't complex. Now, as I say, you've got lots and lots of fruit flies. They talk about three of them who are a bit odd. You know, if you look at a population of people in the world, there are probably very, very short sleepers. I mean, I was involved with researching a Vietnamese guy who, for 30 years, nobody has ever seen him perform a behavior that appears to be sleep. That's not to say that he doesn't have micronaps or whatever, but nobody has seen him. So he may be the absolute extreme on one end. And it may be that, say, in a whole colony of fruit flies, there were just three weirdos. But The fact that they can do it means that it is obviously possible. The problem with the longevity is, you know, humans can live for 100 years. I have no idea how long your average fruit fly lasts for. So even if you don't sleep for the whole life of a fruit fly, is that enough to reduce your lifespan? I don't know. But it does throw up the possibility that sleep is not something that we have to do every day. As I mentioned Randy Gardner earlier, I mean, after 11 and a half days of sleep, he went to bed for 10 hours and that was it. And he got up and he felt fine and never had a problem. So even under that massive extreme where you'd have thought he'd have gone to bed for 2 or 3 days to recover from it, he didn't. It was just 10 hours. So maybe the body is robust enough. Maybe we can cope. I mean, in the same way we can live off fast food. We're not going to be the healthiest we're ever going to be, but it's not necessarily as negative as we perhaps have been told that it is. But in times of stress, people can go 48 hours or so without sleep, even more, 72 hours without sleep and not have any negative effects. So I think, you know, we're not going to be able to do without sleep for 100 years and still be healthy. But I think, you know, having a poor night every once in a while, or perhaps having, you know, an hour less sleep every day than we should do. I mean, we have this very prescriptive, everybody needs 8 hours. and, you know, a certain very famous sleep researcher says, you know, that short sleep equals slow death. But maybe it's not. Maybe it's not as bad. You know, in the general scheme of things, you know, we live longer than we've ever done before. Even if we are sleep deprived or losing sleep, maybe we're not as sensitive as we perhaps believe we are. Maybe we are robust. But again, we survived these things. We survived the time when saber-toothed tigers would eat us and marauding tribes would try and kill us. And we know from the work, I mean, the wonderful work they did with sloths. Everybody thinks sloths are lazy, and they are lazy in the lab when they get fed. They sleep for 20 hours a day. But you stick them in the wild and they've actually got to move for their food and something might eat them and they only sleep for 9 hours a day. So if all your bodily needs are met, then of course you can sleep because there's nothing else to do. If you have to do something, I don't think sleep is, it's a biological need, but I don't think we're as sensitive as some people try to make out.
Well, this is something they actually brought up in this study. Perhaps in the wild, these fruit flies would be sleeping longer because the lab environment, there's no predators.
Yep.
They can bumble around, you know, chill out, do whatever fruit flies like to do to relax. They're not going to be eaten by anybody.
Yep.
And one of the questions they raise is that, which is kind of what you touched on, you take any animal out of this survival mode where they've got all the stresses of being eaten by saber-toothed tigers or whatever, and you put them in an environment like a modern human environment now, we've got all our needs met. Perhaps this idea of sleep as a biological necessity isn't as cut and dried as what we're led to believe. You know, maybe we've got more resources, more mental resources, psychological resources, and also physiological resources to be more resilient against this thing that's drummed into us, you know, 8 hours sleep, 8 hours sleep. And I'm not saying that people shouldn't have regular sleep and apply sleep hygiene. I'm not saying that at all. But I find this fascinating because bottom line is we're never ever going to know the true answer to this because, well, we can't do experiments on humans and say, you know, you guys go without sleep for 20 days, you guys for 5 days, because, you know, some people might die. So ethically, we'll never have those experiments. But I could see people looking at this kind of research and say, oh, actually, that's interesting. Fruit flies don't need to sleep. Maybe there's some way we can tweak human biology and introduce micro sleeps, some drugs here, nootropics, and we get away from this idea that this sort of paradigm that we're led to believe of consolidated sleep, 8 hours or whatever at night.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at the changes, it wasn't that long ago that we all lived in wooden huts that were not protected from the elements, weren't really protected from predators, you know, didn't have windows, didn't have locks. And we now live in, you know, brick-built houses with burglar alarms and double glazing. And we've become soft. You know, we now have luxury beds that feel lovely and comfortable rather than a sack of hay on the floor. And I think this is it. We're under so little stress in our lives. I know people invent stresses, but we are, from an evolutionary point of view, we've never had it so good. And maybe sleep is a luxury. Maybe we do need it, but we don't need as much of it as we believe we do. And this 8 hours is, of course, a myth. It's never been an ideal. It's just an average. And maybe if life was a bit tougher, I mean, from history, when we introduced the word insomnia in around 1889, 1890, and there was a massive peak between 1890 and 1913 about talking about poor sleep. And then the First World War happened, and then the Depression, and then the Second World War happened. So nobody was going to complain of insomnia or not sleeping until around the 60s, when all of that sort of, you know, came out of the wash. Yeah. And then we would, then I say, we just need something to complain about. And I say, maybe we should learn from fruit flies that, you know, we should relax a bit more. It's not going to kill us anytime soon, and you know, don't worry about it. If you're not getting your 8 hours sleep, then don't worry about it. Try the next night.
Totally. I mean, I don't want to give the impression that we're advocating to deny sleep hygiene and getting good sleep. But I love this study that comes out because it pricks a bubble. Maybe it's not as simple as that. Maybe, you know, maybe there are nuances here
At the end of the day, this isn't a dress rehearsal. This is your one life. Yeah. And nobody's ever going to go to their deathbed thinking, I wish I'd got 8 hours sleep every night.
Exactly. Common sense, Neil. I think we're together on that one.
Never going to be rich selling common sense, though.
Well, thanks so much for your input on those.
Pleasure as always, Jeff. Cheers.
Really nice to dive behind the headlines a bit. And hopefully we can do this again sometime in the future.
Absolutely, Jeff. Cheers.
You've been listening to the Sleep Junkies podcast. If you like this episode, don't forget to subscribe. And you can check us out on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and on the website, sleepjunkies.com. Hope to see you on the next one. Sleep well.